This week on Daiwa, we're discussing Fremont County. A man is dropped off at home after the birth of his son, but is never seen again.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
Okay, we are in Fremont County. I've never been there, at least not to my knowledge. Have you been?
I think I have driven through it, but I have not like stayed or seen anything.
I guess is that on the way to Colorado, probably?
I think it's on the way to Kansas or Missouri.
I've been to Kansas.
Let me just pull up a map quick.
I've probably driven through it, is my conclusion, without even seeing your map.
Yeah, it's like on the border of Missouri, Nebraska, that area.
Sure. Okay, cool.
But it is the most southwest county in Iowa and also home to the Todd House. Do you know anything about that?
I know nothing about the Todd House.
All right. So according to the Tabor Historical Society, the Todd House is located at 705 Park Street in Tabor, Iowa. It was built in 1853 for the Reverend John and Martha Todd and was the third structure built in Tabor. Reverend Todd was one of three abolitionists who founded the town, and these abolitionists believed their Christian faith demanded that they fight the injustice of slavery by providing assistance to any who arrived on their doorstep seeking freedom. And as the village's spiritual leader, Reverend Todd visited the topic regularly in his writings and sermons. And one example we found was a sermon he delivered on July 20th of 1856 titled National Judgment. He said, quote, "God delivered us from British oppression, and instead of freeing the slaves, which, according to the principles upon which our fathers based their right to freedom, were equally entitled to liberty, we held them still in bondage. Thus our fathers took to their bosom the chilled viper."
Wow, very
powerful. Yes. So Reverend Todd practiced what he preached, and the Todds participated in several rescues in the Underground Railroad and were even visited by the famous abolitionist John Brown. Reverend Todd describes only five escapes in his autobiography, which you can buy from the Tabor Historical Society, but there were definitely more. One account even describes the former slave owner named Mr. Dennis, who came to Tabor to attack one of the conductors with a cane. He had also employed slave hunters, offering a reward of $50 per person and $200 for information about those who helped. And then on Christmas Day of 1856, Martha Todd wrote a letter to her father in Ohio that said, quote, "Our little place has been visited again by a slave catcher. We supposed warrants would be obtained to search our houses. We feared not the warrants because of finding runaways, but because of some firearms placed in Tabor destined for Kansas." So the Todds were very cool people. They raised seven kids in their house, and their family descendants sold the house in 1955 to local families, and it was eventually purchased by Otha D. Warren, a writer and former U.S. congressman from Iowa, who recognized its historical significance as one of only four surviving Underground Railroad stations in the state. And the property was eventually transferred to the Tabor Historical Society in 1967.
That is a very cool fun fact.
Sorry, it was a lot of me talking.
No, this is why we have the fun facts, people, because they're cool things that I didn't know about before.
Right. We love exploring Iowa.
But also my fun fact is semi-related to the Todd House, even though I didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
In 2004, Marilyn Robinson published her second novel, Gilead, which won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Gilead is a fictional autobiography of the Reverend John Ames, an elderly white Congregationalist pastor in the small, secluded town of Gilead, Iowa, which is also fictional. And he knows that he's dying of a heart condition. If that sounds familiar, it's because Gilead is based on Tabor, Iowa, and Reverend John Ames is based on John Todd. And bonus, bonus fun fact, Gilead has been listed as one of President Obama's favorite books.
Very cool. I think we need to read Gilead.
I know, me too. Putting it on the book club list.
Love it. Well, let's get to the murder. And warning, this one is a cold case. Also, we're citing a lot of reporting from iowacoldcases.org, so just want to do a quick thank you to all the work that that team does.
Yay. So it's 1968. Lyndon Johnson was president. Johnny Cash recorded at Folsom Prison live at Folsom State Prison in California. 60 Minutes premiered on CBS, and it was actually started by a former Iowan, Harry Reasoner, who was born in Dakota City. And just the year before, in 1967, Iowa named the geode as the official state rock, which is a great rock.
I didn't know you can really, like, find geodes in Iowa. I thought they were more of a Colorado thing, so that's funny to me. But I love it.
You definitely can.
Do you know where?
No.
Okay.
My college roommate was an environmental science major, and she took some geology classes. So she would know a lot more than I do, but
we gotta phone a friend.
I know, we really do. Anyways, so in Hamburg, Iowa, on March 4th, Gary Eugene Seebeck was reported missing after his sister-in-law found blood on his living room couch.
Let's talk about Gary Seebeck. He was born December 29th of 1947 to Charles and Ruth Ella Pearson Seebeck. He was only 20 years old in 1968 and had already been married and had a kid with Shirley Moyer, who was the adopted daughter of Victor and Ruth Moyer. The Moyers adopted Shirley along with a son, John, and then they had a daughter either named Jennifer or Janice, who will come into the story.
So according to iowacoldcases.org, Gary started off his last day normally. At 5:30 a.m., his coworker, Paul Bashaw, picks Gary up and they drive to Crown Line Plastic Company in Nebraska City, Nebraska. They both work at Crown Line Plastics. Later that morning, Gary's wife, Shirley, and her sister, Janice Holland, arrived at the company to tell Gary that Shirley was in labor. They all drive to St. Mary's Hospital in Nebraska City with Lisa, Gary and Shirley's two-year-old daughter.
Gary stayed at the hospital until his son, Patrick's birth. Around 10:30 p.m., he gets a ride from Bill and Dina Siddons, who are friends, back to Hamburg. The Siddons drop Gary off at his duplex on Main Street around 11 p.m.
The next morning, around 5:30 a.m., Paul Bashaw stops by the duplex as usual to pick up Gary for work. Paul saw lights on and heard a radio playing in the house. When Gary doesn't come out to the car, Paul gets out of the car and approaches the duplex's kitchen door. He finds the door open and, after entering the home, finds Gary's cigarettes on the kitchen table. He calls out for him, glances briefly into each room, and, finding no one home, gets back into his car and heads for work alone.
Gary never showed up to the hospital either. Shirley's sister Janice and friend Dina went back to the duplex around 9:30 or 10 p.m. that night and found things a little off. First, the lights are all off in the house. Second, the kitchen floor had clearly been mopped. The mop and pail are no longer in the bathroom, where Janice had left it the day before, but near the basement door, and the mop is wet. Third, the basement door is open, and there's a light on downstairs. The fourth thing is, in the living room, two big chairs near the front door have been moved away from their normal positions. Scuff marks, both light and dark colored, are all along the floor where the chairs were pulled away. And finally, fifth, one of three decorative pillows is missing from the sofa, and the pillow on the right appears to have blood on it. There is a much larger stain, something that also appeared to be blood, on the back of the sofa where one's head would normally rest.
So naturally, this freaks the women out, and they go get their husbands. They return with their husbands and contact the Fremont County Sheriff's Office around 10:30 p.m. to report their findings. Sheriff James Finley arrives at 11 p.m. and takes statements from the Hollands and the Siddons. In the kitchen's breakfast area, Sheriff Finley finds a doll sitting in a chair and what appears to be blood specks on the wall above the chair. Within days, an all-points missing persons bulletin is released to the public, along with Seebeck's physical description.
Here are some things that were said to be well-known before Gary's disappearance. Gary's father-in-law, Victor, or Buck Moyer, had taken in and raised Shirley and her brother John as young children, and Moyer's obsession with Shirley went beyond a father's concern for a daughter. Moyer hated his son-in-law with such a passion that he told a number of individuals that he would kill him. Moyer also told a local businessman that one day Gary would just disappear and that Shirley would be coming back to him, meaning Moyer. Also, Gary so feared his father-in-law that during periods when Moyer had forced the couple apart and Sivek stayed with his own father, he slept with the lights on at night and a gun under his bed. At the hospital, on the same day Shirley gave birth, Victor Moyer confronted Gary and argued that the new baby wasn't even his because Moyer had actually fathered his adopted daughter's son. And finally, Moyer dominated every aspect of the young couple's life. Eventually, he persuaded Shirley to divorce Gary Sivek. However, the couple was still in love and planned to remarry and move far away from Victor Moyer's control. They talked about relocating to Florida as soon as their second child was born.
On Wednesday, March 6th, Janice Holland and Dina Siddons go out to Victor Moyer's rural Hamburg residence between 12:30 and 1 p.m. They find Moyer's car parked in a tin shed. The woman looked inside the trunk and found the middle section wet with an unknown substance. They also see blood on the right rear bumper and a corner of the vehicle. The woman left Moyer's property before he returned home.
The Fremont County Deputy Sheriff Gary Stevens and Sheriff Finley also go and pay a visit to Moyer's residence in Hamburg. They found the substance on the rear fender and bumper of Moyer's car, which was a 1958 Sunbeam. They detected other stains on a piece of plastic in the car, on the handbrake handle, and the steering wheel of the car. When they ask Moyer how blood got on the rear of his car, he states that he must have cut his finger. But when they asked which finger he cut, Moyer retracts a statement saying he guessed he didn't cut any finger. Stevens and Finley collect the blood scrapings and other evidence from the scene.
Samples of the fabric found in the apartment containing the stains, like the pillows and scrapings from the kitchen, along with scrapings and portions of the car containing the stains, were taken and sent to the FBI laboratory for analysis. The blood collected from both the vehicle and from the fabric in the Sebeck home will later be identified as type A blood, and Sebeck is believed to have type A blood as well. Tests also reveal Moyer has type O blood.
On March 7th, 1968, between the hours of 1:08 p.m. and 1:22 p.m., Sheriff Finley, Deputy Sheriff Ed Collins, and the reporting special agent Warren D. Stump all interview Moyer at his home in Hamburg in the sheriff's car. Moyer was read the Miranda warning, but stated he wanted to see his attorney, Edwin Gescher. The report from the BCI says Moyer contacted Gescher earlier that morning at the courthouse in Sydney, Iowa.
When asked how blood got on the rear of his car, Moyer said maybe his daughter Shirley or son Gary might know. Also, when asked whether he'd be willing to take a polygraph test around Gary's disappearance, Moyer said he would be very nervous and would need to consult his attorney first.
We also hear from Dorothy Simpson, the Sebeck's neighbor. She tells Deputy Sheriff Stevens that on the night of March 4th, she heard two shots fired around 11:30 p.m. She said she waited 5 to 10 minutes before looking outside and saw that all the lights were on in the Sebeck home. She told her husband about having heard the shots, but he said the sounds probably came from a backfiring car.
On March 14th, Sheriff Finley tells the Hamburg Reporter, quote, "There's nothing new to report on Gary's mysterious disappearance." The Sheriff's Office and Iowa Criminal Bureau of Investigation failed to find any concrete clues to Gary's whereabouts.
Gary's parents had been wintering in Florida and flew home to help in the search. They requested firemen to comb their farm 7 miles southeast of Hamburg Sunday in hopes of just finding something. And the sheriff's office was also looking in the backwaters of the Missouri River.
And then again, on March 20th, we hear there's still no leads, according to Deputy Sheriff Ed Collins. But on April 24th, Shirley Moyer receives a typewritten note and envelope from Hiawatha, Kansas. It's written by a woman named Caroline and says that her and Gary have run off together because Gary was not happy with his wife and family. The letter also accuses Shirley's newborn son not belonging to Gary because he was born with black hair.
There was a search warrant addressing a number of letters, both typed and handwritten, in attempts to mislead the BCI's investigation into Gary's disappearance. And the BCI later matched the handwritten letters with Moyer's handwriting and the typewritten letters were also a match to his typewriter that Moyer owned.
On May 13th, Shirley volunteers to two polygraph tests. The results say she did not attempt to deceive or withhold any information. It also reports that she believes her husband is deceased and that her father is responsible for his death. Shirley also expressed her own fear of Moyer and said she was willing to cooperate with authorities in any way.
So then almost a year goes by, and in January of 1969, the FBI gets involved with the search for Gary when he failed to answer a draft board summons. And then in April of 69, we get an update from the Hamburg Reporter that a group of detectives and volunteers were searching for clues on land farmed by Victor Moyer. The group did use metal detectors, but nothing turned up. At this point, Gary had been missing for 13 months, and a search warrant had been obtained.
So the investigation is still ongoing, and Sheriff Collins led a search with help from the Iowa Highway Patrol and officers from surrounding counties. Gary's car, which had not been working for over a year, still remained at his parents' home. Meanwhile, there was also a report that, quote, Mr. and Mrs. Victor Moyer spent last weekend with Mrs. Shirley Seebeck, Lisa, and Todd in Texarkana, Texas, from the Hamburg Reporter.
The next time we hear of Shirley is in July of 1972. She married Marvin Worrell of Linville, Iowa, and the couple together already had four children and was planning to make their home in Tainter, Iowa.
But then there's another strange case that's related. On November 16th, 1974, Melvin Price is driving from Lincoln, Nebraska through Hamburg. At 6:30, he comes to a barricade at the bridge because construction workers are laying cement. Melvin maneuvers his car around the barricades, but quickly becomes stuck in wet concrete. The construction company calls authorities, but the contractor declines to file charges, so Melvin is let go.
Melvin then drives into Hamburg and goes to the VFW club, where he visits with Victor Moyer and Shirley's younger sister, Janice. Someone later reports that Melvin was kissing Janice, but he leaves the VFW around 1:30 a.m., and then at 4:30 a.m., we hear that a trucker finds Melvin's body lying along Iowa Highway 42, about 1 mile west of Riverton. A witness report says it looked like he had been beaten in the head with a crowbar.
And the autopsy report kind of matches that too. Jenny Edmondson Hospital in Council Bluffs listed Melvin's cause of death as blunt force trauma to the head. It was listed as a probable hit and run, but Melvin didn't have any broken bones. Unfortunately, Melvin Price's case also went cold.
Gary's body has never been found, but a gravestone was put up in High Creek Cemetery in Rockport, Missouri for him. He's buried next to his parents, who both died in 2008. Shirley also passed away, but in 2009. She's buried in Hamburg, Iowa with her parents, and her obituary says she had been a hairstylist, loved riding motorcycles, and had done 4 skydiving jumps.
Wow.
Very cool.
Victor Moyer has also passed. He died in 2014 at the age of 94. And we also want to note that Victor's obituary says he is survived by his son John and daughter Jennifer Morford, not Janice. If you have any information relating to Gary's disappearance, please contact the Iowa DCI.
Time to give Taps a call?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, Taps, thanks for joining.
Hello.
We are covering the Fremont County case of Gary Seebeck. Have you ever been to Fremont County?
Many, many, many times.
What do you know about it?
Well, of course, it's home to Hamburg that historically floods during every Missouri River flooding event, and the longest POW of Vietnam was a Navy pilot from Hamburg who just died like yesterday, but I can't think of his name right now.
Like longest living?
No, he was in the POW camp for the longest period.
Oh my gosh.
This is different than the other one that was in for like 7.5 years or something.
He was 7 years and so many months. He was the longest.
Okay. On to the case today. Do you have any idea why like nothing really came from the BCI discovering Moyer was writing fake letters to his daughter about Gary's disappearance?
No, it was interesting because I don't know if there seemed to be a lot of circumstantial evidence, but nobody was really following up. I even detected a little bit of possible blood spatter at the crime scene, which would indicate some high velocity impact to the body, and nothing was spoken about that either. No, so it's just kind of interesting. I mean, there was blood in so many places. The other thing is, it would be interesting to me if some of that stuff was still held, this might be a good candidate for a DNA examination.
Yeah, because there was blood on the car too at Moyer's house.
And obviously there was a lot of motive from the prior statements made. So.
Right.
How would we make that happen?
Well, I mean, the authorities down there would have to decide that that's what they wanted to do. And before we even go down that road, it's very possible a case that old, that much of the evidence has either been lost or not packaged correctly. There could be lots of impediments to try to reopen it.
Do you think they would reopen it even though, like, kind of, I would say most people who were involved have passed already? Is there more push to like open a cold case where maybe family's still alive and wants an answer?
I think that emotionally, yes, yeah, that's true. But I also think there's a little bit of an obligation by law enforcement and prosecution to solve cases, no matter what the circumstances or what who's alive or who's dead.
We do know that Moyer was a pilot, and one theory was that he had taken Gary's body up in a plane and dumped it in the Missouri River. Being a pilot, do you think that that's even possible in a small plane? And if so, how many people would need to be involved to dump a body from a plane while flying it?
It would be exceedingly difficult for a single person to dump a body out of a small plane. It obviously would depend on the type of plane. For instance, a Cessna with a high wing might be easier to dump a body out because the door is below the wing. Whereas a Piper product, such as a Warrior or Cherokee, the wing would be in the way of where the door opens above the wing. So the body could just flop out there on the wing, and it would be difficult. It could ruin the ability of the plane to fly. In either case, just holding the door open in the slipstream in the wind would be exceedingly difficult. So it's not impossible, but I just would really have a hard time seeing how a single person could do it. If he had an accomplice, it may be easier.
Then wouldn't people see that?
No, not necessarily. If you did it at the right time of day or night, and you're flying very low level, and then you think about the late 60s, the radar coverage at that time. No, it probably, I mean, I don't even think transponders were required back in those days, which would have gave air traffic control guys an idea of there is a plane in that vicinity. So you could have done it fairly well undetected. The other thing is, if you get down by Hamburg, where the Nishnabotna River flows into the Missouri, there's a lot of back channel water back in there, different creeks and the Nishnabotna River and some other places. That there's a lot of places you could dump a body, either by plane or by any other means.
Have you ever participated in a water search?
Yeah, we've done a few. The river is exceedingly difficult because the current is so fast. One of the things that happened, the Missouri River doesn't have locks and dams like the Mississippi River. So once the Missouri River gets past Gavin's Point Dam, which is north of Sioux City, it flows at a very high flow rate all the way down to the Mississippi. I want to say like 7 miles an hour or something like that is the current. So searching for bodies in that river is very, very difficult.
How did you search? Did you search by boat or plane?
Boat,
or helicopter?
Helicopter, divers.
Divers will go in the river?
They will go in the river.
Wow.
Again, they will tell you it's extremely difficult. They can't see their hand in front of their face mask. So everything's done by feel. We've had a couple of bodies found by divers by just feel.
Oh.
And people are trained to be divers for this specific situation?
Yep. They train in the river and train how to recover. Oh. In a lot of cases, bodies that are dumped in the river do appear at some point, maybe a month or two later, but not all of them. There have been alleged bodies in the river, both accidental and homicides, that they've never been found.
When they appear, are they way further down?
They're usually down further, and it's something bizarre with the current where they'll go into a certain area or a certain bank, and that's where they found some fisherman or something will find them.
We thought this case was really interesting because there's maybe a connection to another cold case, and that was Melvin Price. He was driving through town, was seen flirting with Moyer's daughter, another daughter, and then ended up dead from a supposed hit and run, but did not have any broken bones. It was just blunt force trauma to the head. Have you seen anything like that before from a hit and run? And what are your thoughts there?
It's extremely varied on the injuries people suffer when they're hit by a car. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where he was struck, how he was struck, the speed. I would be curious to look at the accident. I doubt they reconstructed the accident like we do today, but it would be interesting to see all the different physics that are involved in that wreck. I don't know if it's not possible to have a broken limb or something of some type, but boy, it would just seem to me that if somebody had just trauma, just like head trauma, it's hard for me to imagine how that accident occurred.
So then do you believe the two cases are connected?
Well, obviously there's a pretty strong link. Both of the cases connected to the daughters of this guy. And just, again, the statements he made before the first homicide, it would be obvious that he would be a subject of interest in both cases.
Any final thoughts?
No, again, it'd be interesting to see if they could open this case back up, especially the first one, just for the DNA value, to see once if there is a possibility of trying to get a hit from that DNA. I would assume there are enough relatives and stuff around that we might be able to track that down. But, you know, maybe none of the evidence exists anymore, or maybe none of it was preserved. So.
All right. Well, thanks for joining. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.